You went so up in my estimation and then so down almost immediately. There's a level of history and fact you don't get on the Chris Harris podcast, do you? How about that?
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the Classics World Chat Show, a catalytic converter of classic car conversation, a tailpipe of talk where hopefully the emissions are clean and considered. Now, as ever, I'm joined by my regular co-host, Joe Miller, and as Jeff Ruggles is buried deep in classic car buyer deadlines, we've got our infrequent flyer, Jamie King. Welcome both.
Jeff's not on holiday this week.
Blimey, there's
no, he's not actually.
Books, even though he hasn't turned up.
We're actually recording a couple of days earlier than we would normally, so that's why Jeff is kind of mired in deadlines. But anyway, so that's why, Jamie, you have joined us again with your presence. So yes. Yeah, welcome both of you. As we are recording it a little bit earlier than we would normally, we're a bit premature for talking about what's in the news. So I will instead just give a quick update on our podcast from a couple of weeks ago where we talked about base model beauties.
Yes.
I have to say, we got some fantastic suggestions in the comments. So I really wanted just to rattle through. A few people mentioned the Citroen AX, and actually that was a really good example because I don't know if you people remember, but they were great at bringing out all these special editions that were effectively base model cars with a wheel trim and a fancy graphic.
I can't remember the last time I saw an AX that wasn't in some way base spec, even if it purported not to be. Like, obviously, how many AX GTs do you see to like the debut or whatever the basic one was? And I think unless they are slightly knackered with steel wheels, they just don't look right.
No, absolutely. I totally agree. Someone mentioned the Beetle Jeans edition from the 70s,
yes.
Which I think that's a good choice. Someone had your Germanic tastes, Joe, mentioned the BMW E34, but in 518i spec, which I think is super raspy.
You'd be outrun by wind erosion.
Yes. Someone mentioned the Ford Orion Equipe. I think that's a run-out edition of the Mark II version. Then a base spec Sierra. Now, that's a great one because the very early base spec Sierras had the slatted grille rather than the aero grille. And I'm pretty sure the base spec ones came in a 1.3 with only a driver's mirror, not even a passenger mirror.
There's only
1.3 Pinto as well.
Maximum misery. There's allegedly only one Sierra base left in the country, and I know this because it was at Festival of the Unexceptional. Sadly, for various reasons, it didn't make the cut of our video. But yes, there is one left in the country, and it is on the show circuit.
Someone also mentioned the Fiat Panda as a base.
Again, that's one of those cars that isn't right being anything other than base, is it?
Yeah, it's just fabulous. So thank you for all you who commented on the chat show episode about base models, and do get involved in future episodes. The other thing I wanted to raise is that Joe and I had a fantastic day out a couple of weeks ago up in Bicester at the Classic Collective, where we were doing some video content, but crucially we drove an MG Magnet, a ZB, and it had been modified. It had been engineered with a bit of modern day considerations in mind, and I tend to be a bit of a stickler for trying to keep things stock and original and all this kind of stuff, and this is definitely not that car. And yet, it was brilliant. And I don't know about you, Joe, you had a go in it as well, but I just thought it was so much fun to drive.
Fabulous. I think it's because it was so well considered. Everything, because it had certain things done to it. So like it had uprated shock absorbers and so on, but they were adjustables and they'd obviously been set just so that it kind of got rid of a bit of body roll, but it wasn't rock hard. It had kind of more modern, more supportive leather seats in it, but they were out of a Rover 75, I think. So they looked quite appropriate with pipe leather and so on. And you know, it had a new stereo in it, but it was subtly integrated. And I think it's proof that if you modify carefully, you can keep the look, because externally, it doesn't really look any different. But to drive and to feel, it was fabulous. It felt so sorted. It was brilliant.
And it's one of the reasons why I've chosen this episode with our resident fast car, fast Ford addict, Jamie King, on the call to talk about the subject of modifications. Because if you're someone like me that sort of gets a bit out of shape when someone's put chrome trim around a Jaguar that wasn't meant to have chrome around it, and I go, oh, actually, I won't have that now, thank you. Jamie's had quite a good car ownership history, I think, of modifying cars, but probably tastefully. So I guess the question I want to throw back to you, Jamie.
That's always a personal subject in a matter of taste.
Yes, well, exactly. So the question I want to ask you, Jamie, is there any car that you think shouldn't be modified? Where does the cutoff come, if at all?
Anything you're buying to make money on or want to retain the value on is probably the short answer. Anything that you want to drive and you want to, I mean, obviously from the performance end of the market, we go into sort of tailoring it to what you want to do. It's a car, enjoy it, you know, make it yours. Anything like Cosworth, for example, are now a prime candidate. Every Cosworth I've ever seen has been modified in some way or another. And now all of a sudden, They're all getting returned to standard. Some of them are so-called never been modified in their lives. I'm like, well, I've got pictures of that doing a burnout at Bruntingthorpe, mate, but it's from back in the day. But yeah, so there's all this sort of, you know, everything's going back to standard, but that's because the values have sort of dictated that way. From a driving experience and a personal sort of like ownership experience, I don't know. I don't think there is, because there are so many levels of modification. You know, what do you draw the line at? Are you going to start engine swapping a Fiat Punto with a, you know, converted to four-wheel drive and whatever else? Probably not. But if you then fit the later GT seats or something, or a set of turbo wheels to that, just to give it a little bit, it's, you know, it is horses for courses. So it's a very personal sort of subject. There is no answer. There is no right or wrong answer. Just do what is right for you.
Is rarity a factor?
It can be. It can be, yeah. Because obviously, again, that's so closely linked to values that's where, so the rarity generally means it's worth more money, and that's the reason for it. So it's for me, it's a lot of it, unfortunately, is generally driven by finance and whether you can and can't do it.
So Joe, your Seicento is a modified example, and it's very much kind of personal journey. It feels like a bit like the fourth bridge. You never actually truly finish modifying. You're always doing something to it, but that's a very personal choice, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I would argue, I mean, that car's kind of a unique case in that it's, well, not unique, but it's, I have that car out of sentimentality. I mean, it will never go anywhere. I will have that car forever. But nor, if I were to sell it, I don't think anything I've done to it has added value, as Jamie said. And I don't think you should ever modify with a view to investment. I mean, it's an odd one for me, because I think the line drawing with should you modify comes down to, is it reversible? So, for example, if you put a set of wheels and change the seats, like Jamie said, ultimately that is reversible. You can pull them out and put the standard ones back in. It's when you're cutting the arches out of the bodywork and you're grinding away bits of the bulkhead to make an engine fit in, and then I think you might be going too far. I mean, I know some people who've modified certain classics like 240Zs and things like that, and E-types, where you can make them better with newer stuff, but they keep hold of the engines and they keep hold of the original driveline, so that if one day you do want to put it back, you can, and you never know. And I think that's... I mean, at the end of the day, it's your car, your money, you can do whatever you like. But personally, I draw the line non-reversible.
Yeah, this sentimentality is a very good point as well, actually, because there's a lot of guys that have been building these cars. And what we have seen more and more of is people's first car, funny enough, a bit like you, Joe, they've never got rid of it. And then it's not really worth an awful lot, and it's never going to be worth an awful lot. So you might as well do what you want to do with it and have some fun with it. And we are seeing that quite a lot. Ford seeing is quite a good example, because you go to a show like Classic Ford Show and you'll see some lovely restored original factory spec things like Granadas. And how many Mark 1 Fiestas and Mark 2 Escorts do you see? Mark 1 Escorts you see that nothing like to come out of factory, but that's because that's their journey. That's the owner has gone that because that's their hobby and that's what they've wanted to do with it. And the whole market is there to sustain that. I mean, we featured one on a video actually, shot at Classic Ford Show. And every time I'm looking around, it's got a different engine in it. It's got a Z-Tech engine in it. It's been converted to real wheel drive. Oh yeah. Retro Ford do that, or Burton Power do that, or that's off the shelf, because you can, there's such a market there to literally customize them how you want, up to you what you want. I do think it's different from different scenes, but I don't think you'll find modifications as popular in Jaguar scenes, certainly not in things like Rolls Royce, Bentley and all that, you know, the prestige marks. They tend not to, but that's because of what the owner wants.
We're talking about modification in terms of engine swaps and different suspension and blah, blah, blah. But actually, technically speaking, anything from non-standard, you go and put LED bulbs in your classic, or if you change the radio, technically that's a modification. There's those group of modifications that we always say for a lot of classics, where you can put it on to improve it without necessarily deviating from the point of it. You know, put modern tires on it, put LED bulbs in it so you can see where you're going, put a modern radio in it, put an alternator rather than a dynamo. You know, none of these are original and standard, but they all make it exponentially better without making it worse or less original.
Well, look, I think we've already proven we could probably carry on with this conversation for a very long time, but we're not going to.
Let us know in the comments.
It's a good topic.
Do let us know in the comments. I think that's a very good invite, and do get involved. Do you own a modified classic? Would you ever modify a classic? Maybe I should put a VTEC lump in my Rover SD3.
But, please do.
But there we go. It still had that asthmatic automatic, so maybe not. But I want to get round to our buying roundup, which this week I want us to be fleet managers. I want us to buy fleet cars for our company. But crucially, we're a fleet manager in 1986 40 years ago.
Now, I remember it like it was yesterday.
So how old were you then, Joe?
I was 12 years off being born, so I...
The brief is, you're a fleet manager in 1986 of a small business, and you've got to spec up the company car requirements. So you need to choose a van for the warehouse. You're going to choose a small family hatchback or saloon for your sales reps to go out in, like a medium-sized family car, which is going to be for your sales managers. They're the more office-based ones, but they need something posher for the meetings. And then you're going to choose one for the company boss, the chairman, the MD, whatever. So they're gonna have the posh car that pulls into the company car park. They've usually got that parking space right by the office door, you know, that sort of thing, because they can't be bothered to walk.
And this is assuming you were buying in 1986. So what would have been in the showrooms at the time?
So Jamie, as our infrequent flyer, you can go first. What van are you going to choose for your warehouse?
There's only one, isn't there? What? There's only one van right the way through to today, and that is obviously the Ford Transit. What else? Yeah, 86, you'd get the new generation shaped one, wouldn't you? The Mark III. So it's,
yes.
One of them, 100%, without doubt, Ford Transit van. In fact, I would still have one today.
When I was growing up, the off-license around the corner from where we lived, the guy that ran the off-license had a Ford Transit Mark III, but a bonus edition, which was had a deep blue paintwork and those white wheel trims, yes. And bonus script down the side.
Yes, I remember that. I remember those. Yeah.
It was mega. I think he had superb taste.
I
mean, for an off.
My dad had one, a 2.5 DI one. And I remember when he bought that and I was a kid, I was like, oh, yeah, he's got a Transit. Dad's got a Transit. Yeah, yeah. Running this, like, yeah.
I thought they looked really good, those Mark
IIIs. They did look good. The Transit's anyway. Lost its way a bit these days, but yeah, that era, that Mark III, Mark IV, Mark V, yeah, fantastic.
It drives really nicely as well.
They're really great. They're actually great.
So go on in, Joe. What's your commercial vehicle of choice? I don't think we've basically topped out already on the Transit, haven't we? So
I was going to say, basically, when you set this brief, it was a race to who could pick Transit first, wasn't it? But I thought, well, if you can't go Ford, then you have to go Vauxhall. So, of course, if you can't beat the Transit, you want the fastest vehicle in the West. So I've gone for the Bedford Astromax, a Mark II Astra as a van. Famously, the fastest vehicle on the road at the time. No matter what you were in, how fast you were going, if you were sat in the outside lane in your 911 turbo doing 90 miles an hour, there would still be an Astromax flashing you out the way. And they are fantastic. They again, car-derived vans I love because they drive like a car, but you've got all the practicality. At the front, it's an Astra. So you can have the Astra engine. It's got all the Astra interior refinements for whatever they're worth. And it still drives like an Astra estate, effectively. But you can put all your clutter in the back. They're bomb-proof cars of that era. That kind of GM era Vauxhall is really, really good. Those early GM Vauxhalls. So yeah, I think if you can't have the Transit, then you want the fastest vehicle on the road, the Astromax.
Perfect for a GTE engine swap if we're going back to our two, should you modify a car or not. Yeah.
Now, your warehouse manager might be a bit annoyed that it's a little bit small. Would he have a Bedford Rascal as well, or a CJ, or whatever it's called?
Well, you could have a Rascal. You put it in the boot, couldn't you? Yeah, the speed means it would get them done quicker.
That's true. He could do two deliveries. So you're right. That's very good. So, as Jamie said, the Transit is the most obvious choice. So I think we all left the way clear for you, Jamie, to choose the Transit, by the way. I think we'd have all chosen the Transit.
Thank you very much. It's very kind.
So then I was left with two options, and I will give my honourable mention to my second choice, which was the Sherpa, the Leyland Sherpa, which went through myriad of name changes over the years. I think it started
also known as the LDV Pilot in later years.
I think by 1986, it was a Freight Rover.
Yes, it was. And then it became the LDV Pilot.
A Freight Rover. But I love the Sherpa because it was in James Bond, The Spy Who Loved Me. So, you know, it's got its movie iconic status.
Infamous for having, I think, the worst wheel arch intrusion of any vehicle ever made, even worse than a Peugeot 106.
Yes, but the actual van I would choose, purely for, I don't know, sentimentality, I suppose, is a Talbot Express. Because by 1986, that is the only vehicle to wear a Talbot badge. Because by then, Peugeot Citroën has got its clutches on Talbot. And is Talbot even around? But I don't think it is. I think Solaras and Alpines have gone by that.
That's your campervan routes coming out in you there, selecting a Talbot Express.
Well, we knew it was coming.
Exactly. And you could still get a Talbot Express as a campervan well into the 90s. But I think as a last throw of the dice, I'd go for a Talbot Express van. Square, chunky, dependable.
There's got to be single-digit examples left now.
So now we've got to go on to our little dependable hatchback / saloon that the sales reps are going to go out in. So, Jamie, go for it.
Well, I'm sticking to Ford throughout this because obviously this just highlights Ford's dominance of that era. But it doesn't matter where you want to be, it's a Ford for you. Now, I would have gone with the Mark IV Escort, but someone already had that on the list. So I've gone for the booted version, because I thought, well, you can get more of your file of faxy stuff in the back and more bits and bobs got down the motorway with the Orion. So yeah, I'm going to go with the Ford Orion, probably the 1.6L, just because it's more than the 1.4 Escort that you're going to go for. But so,
and are you still 1.6. Sticking with CVH petrol, or are you going diesel?
No, petrol, CVH petrol.
Yeah, because otherwise he'd be late to all his meetings.
Yeah, I mean, diesels back in 86 were like horrible, weren't they? Let's be honest.
As I used to subscribe to Diesel Car magazine in the late 80s, I can tell you that the 1.6 55 horsepower diesel was replaced in 1988 by the Dagenham diesel 1.8, which had 60 horsepower, and then was turbocharged to create the 90 horsepower version to try and compete with the Peugeot engine, but it was still rough as anything and not as good as the Peugeot units, unfortunately. But
well,
anyway.
There's a level of history and fact you don't get on the Chris Harris podcast, do you? How about that?
I know. It's a bit sad, isn't it? But
no, I think the Orion's a good choice, because there will have been a sector even then that were kind of more traditionalist that didn't want the newfangled hatchback, but still wanted a saloon. So yeah, I think that's a fair choice.
Yeah. So what are you going to match that with then, Joe?
Another saloon, and one very close to home, because I inadvertently ended up going with a lot of British choices for mine. I thought, well, if Jamie's going all Ford, I'm going to try and go all British, but not Ford. So my small rep mobile of choice is the Rover 213, which would, of course, been the SD3 by that point. You're well aware of that one, Phil.
Mm-hmm.
Again, obviously, it was newfangled at the time, Japanese, so bulletproof reliable. You got the Japanese reliability and quality, but you still had traditional British values, so you could still appeal to your British customers with your Rover badge and your nice wood and your nice velour. Again, saloon, traditional, not a massively exciting car, but dead reliable, economical, smooth, well-equipped. You get a 213. We're not flash. We're not going 216. I think a damn sight more refined than the Ford or the Vauxhall it was going up against. So I think that was a connoisseur's choice back then.
Very good. Yeah, I approve. I don't know why I didn't think of a saloon, because as Jamie's already referenced, I went with the Mark IV Escort 1.4L. I don't know why I'm being so miserly and only giving them the 1.4. I guess I could have skimped even further and gone for the 1300, but 1.4, lean burn, seemed quite futuristic, just dependable.
To be fair, it's the car I would have picked if you didn't.
That Mark IV interior, I think, was really good. The L-spec would have only had the clock, the analog clock in the gauge cluster. It wouldn't have had the rev counter, but it had those short little stubby indicator stalks and the thing there. I don't know if it ever had the joystick for the stereo with an L-spec. I can't remember.
No, it'd been an L. That would have had a blanking plates galore. That would have had.
Right, so that would have been GL, and that was probably had the little joystick. And it would have had the flat center console, not the bit that comes up to join the middle bit. So you'd have had
probably
to put your
cassettes.
Tape.
Yeah, you've had none of that.
Cassettes in the middle. So that'd have been perfect. They'd have been putting in there sort of 80s rock tunes in there while, you know, speeding up and down the newly opened M25. They'd have had a nice time.
Well, once again, you don't get this on the Chris Harris podcast, do you?
Painting quite a picture.
No, I'll be honest with you. If I was given the choice back then, if I was sales rep back then, I'd have still gone for my Rover, personally. Yeah, a symphony of Dagenham rattly plastics, but to each their own.
No, I think the Rover's probably a more refined, maybe more mature choice, Joe.
Yes,
so,
yes, indeed. Befitting of a gentleman of your stature.
For someone who was minus 12, it's a very mature choice. So, well
that
done.
Rover just screams Hyacinth Bouquet to me. That's all it does.
Yes, yes.
Motorcyclist Richard? That's all I keep hearing.
Well, there we go. Like, if you are out and about doing sales meetings, it's all about keeping up appearances. So maybe that is exactly
there you go.
Why we should do
there
that.
It is. But, and there's your hook. There's your hook for the credits.
Now, Jamie, it's your turn, because you've now got to choose the sales manager's car, because they're the one in the office, really, but they want to be a bit showboaty sometimes when they go to the big posh meetings in London.
Yeah.
So what is he or she driving in 1986?
In 1986, got to be a Ford Sierra. And if you want to impress someone, 2 litre gear.
Ooh. We're just pre-facelift, aren't we, in 86? So you've still got the kind of aero shape.
2 litre gear.
That's plush.
I would have gone for a Sapphire had this been 1987. 1986, I'll have to stick to the five-door gear.
The GL and Gear models, I think, had a narrower steering wheel. And I think they had the bank of electric window switches in the middle.
Yes. Yeah.
So that looked maximum.
Four electric window switches. Would have had a sunroof probably as well. Well, would have had a sunroof.
And as we found on our own 2 litre gear, you can pretend you've got an XR4i, because Pepperpot wheels you can get on those as well.
We probably shouldn't mention our Sierra Gear project car, because that's still looking a bit forlorn in the office car park.
I can see it from where I'm sat now, gently rotting. Those of you asking about it, it will come to the channel eventually. Once the Mondeo's finished, we will start Project Sierra eventually.
Yes, it's due to make its way down to me in the next few weeks, I think.
Your guy's got a Sierra, so Joe, what's your guy going to drive up? You know, if they're going to go and meet for a game of golf, they're going to have to impress each other. So,
If you're turning up on the golf course in 1986 and you want to impress, but you're kind of in that 2 litre class, you're in luck, sir, because I can get you a brand new, in fact, launched this year, Rover 820. Because, of course, the flagship Rover replaces the SD1, modern, sleek styling by Royax, the kind of floating roof design. Japanese engineering is getting, although the 2 litre engine is a Rover engine, but we'll gloss over that. But modern, sharp, but also crucially, you could get one with steel wheels, with cloth, with the 2 litre. We talked about base specs before. So you might well find that if you fiddle the company tax books a little bit, you could get an 820 in the same kind of pool as you'd get your Sierra gear, but you're one class bigger, which means you're better. So yeah, sticking with my theme, I'd go all new, all modern, Rover 820.
That's a very good choice. And actually, I think it looked quite good with the sort of hubcaps with the plastic wheel trims and stuff. And that styling, I think, was really nice.
I'm sure looking back to the modification thing, there's one on eBay at a minute on air at 18s.
Yes, I have seen that.
Really good.
Well, all I will say is on the subject of modified Rovers for sale, keep that in mind for later in the podcast. But anyway, all the usual.
You've been a bit generous with your Rover 820. I think he might steal the march in the golf course conversation, because I'm going with a Mark II Vauxhall Cavalier.
Okay. Fair choice. Good choice.
I wrote down GL or CD spec. I think if I was feeling generous, if he'd hit his targets, he'd get the CD spec one with a posher one. Choosing 86 was kind of deliberate in a way, because it was that period of time where I think Ford was still struggling a little bit, flogging the Sierra. Like, I think it was only for the fact they had a massive dealer network and big fleet incentives that they could drive market share for Sierra. Whereas the Mark II Cavalier, I think, was generally recognised by then to be the better of the two cars, because it was front-wheel drive. I think the styling was good. It had a saloon, hatch and estate. I think the Cavalier was a really good choice.
The Mark II SRI going for auction at Iconic Auctions at Carfest in a couple of weeks as well. Alex, there's a few Vauxhalls going for auction, actually, but that looks really nice.
I would so have that. An SRI spec. Actually, that's what the sales guy would have. He'd have one of those. He'd want to be a bit sporty.
I know we've spoken about this in the past on this sort of chat show, and about Ford's marketing might and how that sort of dragged up the sales. Interestingly, 86 was before the RS500 came along, before they had any success on the BTCC circuit. So, yeah, it's quite interesting that obviously from 87 onwards, I think between 87 and 90, that an RS500 won pretty much every race, every round of the Touring, not the same one, obviously. There was an RS500 that won. That then sort of had the halo effect for the Sierra. And it was interesting to see how the Mark II came along, and the sales then sort of went up off the back of that. Yeah, you're right. In 86, I think the Cavalier versus Sierra was a closer sort of run thing.
We've treated everyone to their appropriate vehicles. So now, as the company boss needs a posh car. So, Jamie, are you going to do a Ford clean sweep here?
I could do. And if I did, I'd probably go with a Mark III Granada, newly launched or year old, whatever it is, Mark III Granada. Although I do quite like the earlier Mark II. But I'd go for that. But I'm not. I'm actually going to go off-piste slightly and go with a real sporty car that I actually still want today, and that's a Mercedes 190E Cosworth. Because if you're going to be boss man, you want to rock up in something that's probably not a Ford.
With a dog leg manual as well.
Yeah, proper lovely, well, proper car. So yeah, that's what I would put down for my... Well, if I was the boss, that's what I would choose. If I was choosing for somebody else, I'd probably choose the Granada and go for the Ford clean sweep. If I was the boss, then yes, that's what I would have.
Well, I guess with Cosworth Engineering, there's still a Ford connection, right? An excellent choice. So yeah, very good. Joe, you've got to top that, sir.
So I'd be honest with you, I was sort of sticking with my British theme, and I sort of thought, well, I can't really go any further up from here. I've kind of climbed the top of the Rover ladder. Obviously, we're not going Rolls or Bentley. That's ridiculous. Range Rover, definitely not happening. I avoided Jaguar for reasons that will become apparent very shortly, I'm sure. So in the end, I just went a very small climb up the ladder, because obviously the Rover 800 launched in 1986. And if you are the sales manager type, then you'll have the 820. But you could also get an 825 Sterling, which got you your alloy wheels, that got you your leather, that got you your V6 with your Japanese. It sounds a bit like an NSX if you drive it like a hooligan. That would be where I'd go. I'd go just one step up the ladder, because this is a very discreet, subtle company. The bloke in charge is earning more, but he's not flash about it.
It's a good choice. I like it. I somewhere back there, I've got a model of the 825.
Of course you do.
What colour, Joe?
Well, it has to be green.
British racing. It's got to be that green, isn't it? That's the one that instantly came to my mind as well.
Yeah. I think subtly top spec is where I'd go with the right. I'd even be tempted to debadge it just for the maximum class.
Yeah, very good. Well, look, regular listeners can always pause at this point and reflect that I've chosen a Talbot, a Ford, and a Vauxhall. So what's my fourth choice going to be? So you can pause and then decide for yourself and then play again. But it's a Jaguar.
Wow.
Because in 1986, the XJ40 has just been unveiled.
Yes, of course. Big year for Britain.
Therefore, I can just wander down to my local dealer and hand over my slightly down at heel Series 3 model and part exchange for the new XJ40 3.6 Sovereign with the square headlights and all that kind of stuff. If I'm a bit like your guy with the 825 Sterling, Joe, I could probably skimp a bit and go with the 2.9 with its slightly wheezy half a V12 engine.
I was about to make a joke about how you would go into the Jaguar dealer, drive out in your XJ40 and wonder why none of the gauges worked and they were all LED. But coming from the chap who's chosen a fleet of Rovers, I think I might keep quiet.
Yes.
So, what could possibly go wrong, Joe?
British engineering, never doubted it.
An interesting observation about all of our choices, gentlemen, is that there is not a single Austin in that lineup. There is not a Montego or a Maestro or a Metro in any of our choices. I know you've gone very Britishy, Joe, with your Rovers, but no one chose a Maestro or Montego.
I lent more towards the Rover because I sort of thought at the time the 213 would have looked like the more progressive choice, whereas at the time the Maestro Montego still carried this stigma a little bit because the early ones were quite poorly made and everything else, whereas everyone sort of knew the Rover was Japanese and therefore a safer bet, but you could still look British. So I think, much as I like the Maestro Montego, even now, given the choice, I'd sooner go for the Rover.
Let us know in the comments, guys. What do you think?
It's funny because my Merc's the only German car on there as well. If you look at the modern day fleet of managers' cars, the van's all VW, the manager stuff's all BMW, the mid manager stuff's all Audi, and then, you know what I mean, they're all German. Not the only chosen one.
That speaks of the era a little bit, doesn't it? Because back then, you could have a BMW 520 base spec, nothing on it, or you could probably have the Sierra 2 litre, even 2.8 gear, you know, with all the bits and pieces on it. And back at that point, that would have been the choice to do, is go for the lower level brand with more kit. Whereas by the 90s, people were doing the opposite. They were having a base spec 3 Series instead of a top spec Mondeo. So I think it speaks of the era. Yeah, exactly. Well,
don't be surprised if we come back to Fleet Manager in the future, but it might be in 1996 or 1976. But let's see what choices we come up with then. Because I'm
already nabbing the Mondeo, by the way.
Oh, God.
That was a lot of fun, guys. Thank you very much. That was a good roundup. I enjoyed being a fleet manager. I think actually I'd still like to be a fleet manager today. So
You kind of are, aren't you?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. But anyway, right. So we move on to what we're up to in the weekend / near future. Jamie, why don't you kick us off? What are you up to?
Well, I'm actually cleaning cars. I hate cleaning cars. I know it's going to come as a surprise because every petrolhead's supposed to enjoy washing their car and like nothing more than spending all day outside with a bucket and a sponge. I'll be honest with you, I hate it. I'm not a car cleaning fan at all. I'm not as bad as Phil because my cars aren't green, but that's not the point. But what I am testing out is G-Technic, who are obviously very well known for their ceramic coating technology and stuff, have just launched a product that is designed for people like me who want to have the protection, but don't necessarily want to spend all day to get there. So this is a product that is basically designed to be applied at home to offer the ceramic protection without having to have a pro detail, without having to have it locked out of the rain and out of the dust and stuff overnight. You just wash your car, clean your car, dry it off. And then the kit has got like a panel wipe just to clean the surface. And then you can prep everything you can coat everything with the actual sort of GT1 product. So the same product goes over, it does paintwork, obviously, but it does things like carbon fiber trim, plastic trim. You can do your wheels, you can do your glass, you can do everything. So it's perfect for me because I can just literally lard it on, buff it off, walk away and go, right, there you go, 12 months protection. I'm happy. Thank you very much.
Lovely.
So, yeah, so that's my plan.
What about you, Joe?
Because this weekend, I don't know. I've got plans to get out on the bike, as is always the way when it's sunny, but I'm going to make a very quick mention. I spent last weekend at the Weald of Kent Steam Rally, Steam Fair. Which was tremendous. It was absolutely massive showground, hundreds and hundreds of steam-powered vehicles, a lot of steam-powered lorries, which I'm not very familiar with, but they were great. Traction engines going up and down all day, and they're just beautiful things. I love the engineering in them. Yeah, that was a great day out. And there was a classic car show going on, so I took the Merc down, and the interior is now about an inch thick with dust everywhere because obviously there's been no rain, so that's going to be cleaning out. And I do have to make a quick mention, there was, because there was a car show going on, and there was lots of your typical MGBs and what such. But it, for those of you watching, was also this, which is quite obviously a kit car. It's also, it's Mark 1 Fiesta based originally. So the idea is you buy a Mark 1 Fiesta and you can put the running gear in it, and it's fiberglass bodied thing. But this particular one is a one-off electric version. So back in the 90s, the company who made it, I can't remember the name off the top of my head, built their own 24 horsepower electric motor. You put batteries in it. And the theory was it gave the same sort of performance as a Fiesta XR2, but with electric power. And the chap was talking about it, and he put a modern Nissan Leaf battery in it for longer range and that kind of thing. And I know we're not entirely pro-EV, or I'm sure some of you watching aren't entirely pro-EV, but I found it fascinating. The homebrew electric stuff, I really, really enjoy. So yeah, that made my day in a weird way. That was probably my favourite car there.
Well, very good. I'm glad you're taking interest in current affairs. But
yes, very good. Anyway. We're positively charged about it, yes.
Yes, good, good. All right, yes, that was a bit of a shock. But anyway, I'm painfully well. I've got loads of other car show commitments in the couple of weekends after that, because I'm going to go up to the Tatton Park Classic and Retro Revival the weekend after, 15th. And then we're all at Trax Silverstone on the 16th. And then we've got Ford Fair the weekend after on the 23rd. So I've got weekends on the bounce. Last weekend was Box and Gas's Megaphonics Porsche event at Bicester. And the only reason I mention that is because it gives me a shameless opportunity to plug one of our other Bookazine products, the Porsche air-cooled Restomod Bookazine, which is edited by Dan Furr, who's our editor on 911 and Porsche World and Classic Porsche. And I have to say, it's a fantastic book. You soon realise the sort of the strength of that aftermarket scene, and sort of, we talked about it at the start of the show, modifying and modernising classic cars. All that Bookazine is all about that. So if you are interested, we'll put a link in the description and you can check it out. My final thing I must plug today in the shops, the latest Classics World print paper version of our output is here, the September issue, which gives us a nice little roundup of some daily driver classics.
I will let you off for running long, because I can see a W123 on that cover.
There is a W123, there's a Volvo, an MGB GT and a Triumph 2000. So a nice little spread of eras of daily driver classics. So there we go. So listen, we're want of the week, chaps. This is the bit where we can indulge. We can pretend to spend as little or as much as we want on our next classic car purchase. So Jamie, what's your want of the week?
I've got this odd Mercedes itch I need to scratch at the minute. Everything I keep looking for, I keep seeing fast Mercs, basically, and I want one. Even down to, I was looking the other day at the ML63 to see if I can justify one as a family wagon. And it's just like, I just want something.
You went so up in my estimation and then so down almost immediately.
I don't care. I just want that 6.2 litre V8 in my life. But it's but the one that I saw on, it was actually on, it was a Facebook post, but it's a link to an eBay ad. It's a W124, a twin turbo Technics modified 3-litre straight six, 300 CE. Massive two-door pillarless coupe, 3-litre straight six, that has then been modified with various different bits. Going back to the start of the conversation about should you modify a classic car, this one's been modified how I would want to modify one. A quaff diff, manual conversion, twin turbo from Turbo Technics bolt-on kit, forged rods and pistons, whatever else. But it just looks tough, and it's just the way it, lovely car. I mean, it just looks fantastic. Anything of that era, big, powerful Mercedes. It's, I don't know why I've got a real itch for one.
If anyone's watching who's got a 500E that they would swap for a Mondeo ST24, do get in touch.
All right then, Joe, you're on to the week.
This is another Facebook Marketplace find. I was scrolling one night, as you do, and my girlfriend was sort of quietly putting these away, and she very nearly fell over by how loudly and suddenly I just went, "Oh, I want that!" when I saw it. And it blends quite seamlessly into our fleet choices, because it combines my Rover fleet with, Jamie, bizarrely, your Transit in one way. So it's a Rover P4, and you know how much I love a P4? Flatbed. There you go.
Nice.
Have a look at that. Now, that is a DIY conversion. It's been made into a motorcycle transporter. So it's got a flatbed in the back with a ramp, so you put bikes in it. And it's a homemade chassis conversion. Because the Rover P4 is a separate chassis, you can take it off and cut the body apart, and there's no strength in it like a monocoque, so you can do it separately, which is what they've done. They've made it into that flatbed. And the Transit connection, you ask? It's got a 2.5 DI Transit engine in it.
Oh, cool.
So I'm sure there will be those of you screaming that this is utter heresy, but I love that. I thought that was absolutely fabulous. And it really,
I don't know, the redneck
really
in me loves that.
It's 6.5 grand, which is not nothing, but for blending my love of P4s and my love of motorcycles,
I want that immediately.
That's excellent. I very much approve. I think that's just all kinds of cool.
Yeah.
I'm about to shatter all the illusions of cool with my Wand of the Week, chaps, just to bring you all crashing down to earth. Because in my book about British Leyland that I've been reading, one of the great tragedies of the 70s was the Austin Princess, or the various incarnations of Leyland Princess and so on.
What might
but
have been?
But I did find for sale, and I'm kind of hoping it's still for sale, a 1981 version of the Austin Princess, an HL1. It's got the 2-litre O-series engine, I think, by then, because it's the Series 2 Princess. So it's perhaps the car that always should have been when it rolled out the factory.
Yep.
It's up for £5,650. It's in this really quite bright and baldy yellow, but I would so have it. I think it's just wonderful.
That's very you. Fabulous choice. I really like those.
All good choices, gentlemen. But
yeah, what a trio. That's fantastic.
Yes.
If you just for reference as well, mine was up at like that one I saw was 17 grand. So it was quite a lot more money than your two.
Right. Yeah. So we could have had both of mine and Joe's choices and change to spare. Well, look, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time today. I've thoroughly enjoyed that eclectic mix of classic car talk. That was brilliant. Viewers, listeners, thank you very much for your time and all your continued support. Don't forget to give us a comment, a like, a subscribe, a follow, a rating or a review. All of those things help spread the word of this merry little classic car chat show. So we do hope you continue on our journey with us, and we look forward to seeing you again next week. Ta-da.
See you later.